Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, actor Jonathan Sketch talks about a career in horror and what it was like getting to work with the late, great George A. Romero. Filmmakers Lauren Wolkstein and Christopher Radcliffe talk about creating their psychological thriller, The Strange Ones, and rapper Cyrus Sci-Fi Smith on the musical culture of Atlanta and getting to open for Cardi B. That's all coming up on today's show. My first guess might not be a household name, but Jonathan Sketch has become somewhat of a revered figure in the horror film world, starring in many B-movies as well as mainstream cinema. Within the horror genre, he has appeared in such films as Quarantine, Prom Night, Living Hell, and Jackals. He has also appeared in later fare, including his breakthrough role as the lead singer of The Wonders in the Tom Hanks film, That Thing You Do. He has co-starred with Bruce Willis three times in The Prince, Marauders, and Vice. The latter with John Cusack, his co-star in the 2017 film Arsenal. However, Sketch's biggest contribution to film might just be his role in creating a sequel to one of the most loved B-movies of all time. That film is Roadhouse, with the late, great Patrick Swayze. Sketch wrote and starred in the direct-to-video sequel in 2006. His latest project is a return to his favorite genre, horror, in The Day of the Dead Bloodline, which is a reimagining of George A. Romero's classic 1985 film. This conversation went in directions I didn't necessarily expect it to go, and it became a bit emotional at times, surprisingly. But here is my chat with Jonathan Sketch. Jonathan Sketch, hello, welcome. Thanks for being here today, man.
Pleasure, my honor.
So you are appearing in a new film that's coming out tomorrow, Day of the Dead Bloodline. I know, and this is obviously a remake of the George A. Romero classic, I know you're a big fan of the horror genre, and this film sort of takes me back to the old-time horror gore fests. What do you like about this type of horror film specifically?
Well, this particular film, I really loved it because I got to play a creature. I actually get to be like what Doug Jones does with Guillermo del Toro and all his films. I get to actually put on a monster mask, and exciting for me. I don't think this is zombie because of the nature of the kills, the thrill kills, and that's one reason we watch them, is to see what can, you know, how you can kill a zombie or not. But the George Romero, he always had these really underlying... more than it dealt with the dead. So, and the corruption and the problems that are going on with the living. So I get a kick out of that. I think I got a kick out of it more studying the press than I did for the film. I was really into my creature, how I was going to create him. So... I agree with you.
I know you actually got to work briefly with George A. Romero years ago on a script for an adaptation of From a Buick 8. What was that experience like for you, working with a legend like that, and do you think he would approve of this film?
He wouldn't give it too much thought. He would enjoy some of the kills and thrills, and the relationship between Max and Zoe he would get a kick out of. But I know he made these, consistently making these films because they were successful and they continually wanted more of them. So he was very, very smart man and knew his horror very well. All the topics, the underlying currents of the films are more interesting to him. I enjoyed working with him. He was very smart. His whole team was really intelligent, and they're consistently pressuring me and Chismar to make everything much better. We did such. But he was going through a tough time, I think, when I was working with him. He was up in Toronto. He was working in a hotel. He was living in a hotel. He's going through a divorce. And that's what I can remember about George. He had great ideas. I'll tell you that. He made everything better.
You mentioned, of course, Doug Jones, who I think for a lot of actors is sort of become the poster child for prosthetics. How was that process to you, getting used to having all that on your body, and did you sort of look at any of his work to maybe draw from there?
Yeah, I did a film with him called Quarantine, and I got to know Doug, and he was such a very special actor, not only just because he knows all the creatures, but he has a sensitivity and a physicality to him that is just extraordinary. So I got to watch him process through his character, and he really got into the character, and he was allowed to get into the character. So when I, you know, me going through the makeup process and everything, I knew to use that experience as much as I could every single day to start to work on the nuances that I was going to try to do that day and the things I was trying to get across with the creature. I got to work on that creature a great deal. It was 4.5 hours of makeup. but I had done makeup work on the character Jonah Hex on The Legends of Tomorrow. So I knew I was going to be sitting in the makeup chair most of the day.
How do you train your body and in yourself as an actor to get used to something like that? Because I feel like as actors, you're always sort of, you know, on the move and you're trying to, you know, get into a certain zone, and to just sort of have to sit still and allow this process to happen. Was there any sort of adjustment that you had to do?
Ever since I first started acting, all the actors, all the older actors that I worked with told me how precious the time in the makeup chair was, no matter how long it was, that you would use that time to prepare for the day. I don't know if it's like that nowadays with everyone looking at their phones and they're constantly need input. But I watched, you know, some of the greatest actors just sit in their chairs, get their makeup done, be quiet, be still, and then go out there and perform. It's their chance to be, and you know, the rule was in those makeup rooms, you had to be quiet, you had to be still. You could listen to music, you know, but you didn't want to be rowdy. You don't want to be rowdy amongst those actors because that was their time to prepare. So I took that. You know, I couldn't do anything because I couldn't even look at my phone or anything. They gave me earpieces that I could listen to podcasts and stuff like that, anything that I wanted to be able to do. But I'm such a visual guy. I wanted to, you know, keep looking at, like, you know, Gary Oldman's Dracula, and they started to be able to set everything up for me so I could watch some, you know, older films I wanted to pull from and stuff like that. That was a great part about being in that chair.
But I imagine that actually must have helped your performance since the character of Max is, you know, 95% a non-vocal character, other than maybe sort of grunts and growls here and there.
Yeah, I had done this. I went to the set and watched Sean Penn play I Am Sam, and I basically learned everything from that experience. Even though I've worked with great actors, but I really went through his process with him and how he approached, you know, leaving the makeup trailer, going into his trailer, going up to the set, And taking all the nuances of things that he had worked on, like one part of his character was Stan Laurel. He had pictures of Stan Laurel everywhere from Laurel and Hardy. And so he had told me he had watched, you know, pretty much every Stan Laurel thing there was. And he was taking the physical comedy from Stan Laurel. And then every time he went out, before he would walk on stage, he checked his makeup, his hairline. He shaved his hairline a little further back for the character. Then he'd listen to music to get him in the groove. So I did those things. I always do those things. I have certain things that I go to remind myself of my toolbox. And then I let the toolbox go just before I walk on the set so that in the moment I can have all these things to pull from. And you're right, I had to pull from a lot of them. And, you know, sometimes the director just wouldn't get what I was trying to get across. And so I just try something else. That was the other thing that Sean taught me was just try something else. You know, just keep going after your goal, and there'll be another obstacle in the way. And if I can't get what you're saying, you know, continually try different things, and hopefully it'll come across and help tell the story.
Given the amount of, you know, physical action involved in this film, was there any maybe special training or regiment you underwent to get yourself into that zone?
Well, when I first read the script, and I was honored to be offered something like this. I've played, you know, character. I'm a character. A lot of people say I'm a character actor. I'm really a leading man. So you don't see leading men get to play these kind of roles that often. So when I got it, I was like, God, I'll never get to do this again. I mean, this could be my Frankenstein. Hopefully someone along the line will be able to see that I can play creatures. I'm very physical. But what I did was I thought, wow, I'm going to make this guy more imposing than I've ever seen a zombie be. And I kept looking at I Am Legend and Dash Mihawk in that. And I know it was CGI, but I thought, you know, if I could get that feeling where he's so physically scary, I think it would be great for the story. So I started to train in the weight room. I started eating almost 6,000 calories a day. I was eating so much food, it was nauseating. Just because I kept seeing this image of, like, okay, every time I read the script, I kept seeing the Hulk and how he was trying to be delicate with the, you know, with the people that he cared for, but he was just a freak. He was just, you know, so much gamma rays are pulsing through him. I felt the same thing about Max. Yeah.
Why do you think zombies have been so in for so long? Like, why do you think that world has continuously resonated with people over the years?
I think the zombies resonate with us because we're all going to die, and people around us are dying, and people we love die, and it makes us deal with how we're living our lives. Just a moment before our death, we have to look back at our lives. In scripture, is called the Judgment Day, and I think that everyone, you know, can look at zombies in that way, and you tell stories from there too. You know, there's a lot of great stories that come from looking at your life at your funeral or from the other side. Like, how did I live my life?
How do you think you would survive in a zombie apocalypse? And do you have any tips in case it might happen?
Zombie apocalypse happened. I have my guns locked away, and I would tell everyone to get behind me. We'd just be fine. Lock ourselves in a room.
What I found really interesting about this film is, even though Max is kind of a despicable character, for me, he's not the least sympathetic character in the film. And both in Max, and especially in Miguel, it was quite an explosion of toxic masculinity. And, you know, given sort of the cultural moment that we're in right now, how do you think that issue will be addressed both in cinema and in society going forward?
You nailed it, Dan. That's the great thing about this movie. that we can have this conversation. Because, you know, I had such the problem when I had a strike, Zoe, when he tried to hold her down, and he kept pushing me to go further and further with it. I was like, well, that's domestic abuse. That's rape. These things are just not going to be okay. No one's going to care for this character at all. And then I realized that that was the point. However, you could make the argument that even in the subtleties, there's rape. You know, the slapping or punching someone in the face obviously is domestic abuse. But at what point is it that when she says no, that he continues moving forward? That's why I didn't felt like I needed to have the domestic abuse. So these issues that are underlying this movie are some of the bigger ones that we have in our society today. There's no way that anyone watches it, it's not going to have the visceral reaction.
What do you think cinema and maybe art in a more broad sense can do to help us advance conversations and have dialogue that otherwise might be uncomfortable?
That's what I think horror films in particular can do. They can deal with some of those tragedies that are affected in our social consciousness that's happening now. And Romero always talked about those things. He would use those things in the underlying characters and stuff like that, so that we would have these kind of conversations after we left the horror film. We're seeing it with Get Out. I think that's where storytellers are going to start to be able to mask these horror films with these really deep, meaningful equations of telling a story. I would say the root of the thing is never the thing itself.
What would you say is your...
We're not remotely close to solving this issue. I mean, men have to really look at themselves like they've never looked at themselves before. Very hard thing for, anyone my age to do. I'm lucky to be an actor, to be able to have to look at myself. I have a son I have to raise. I have to bring him up in the world. Okay, I'm sorry.
It's all right. What would you say your favorite overall horror film is?
Man, that's not fair. It's just not fair. I keep thinking Jaws is a horror film. Do you agree?
I mean, yes and no. Like, I think when the era was made, it would be considered a horror film, but I'm not sure how it would be classified today specifically if we look at the horror canon and genre, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree, but it is a horror film. I love the latest It. I thought that was just pure genius. And I'm gonna throw a different one out there. Have you ever seen Frailty?
Yes, I love Frailty. Bill Paxton.
Yeah, that's super, super intelligent horror film. I love that movie.
And finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your involvement. You wrote and started a sequel to one of the greatest B-movies of all time, Roadhouse 2. I got to ask you about that experience.
I was standing in the middle of the road in Maryland, and I called the head of Sony at the time I could do that. And I called him and I said, listen, I need to work. I'm having serious issues. I just need to work on something. And he told me, he gave me a list of things that I could jump into right away. And, Roadhouse, I love Roadhouse. It's one of my favorites. So he said, and I was like, wow. And I was like, let me read it. And I read it and I was like, man, I have to. Can I try to make this better and make it something that you guys will, put in the theaters and really get behind? And he said, absolutely. And so they actually paid me and Richard Chismar to get in there and make it um, make it better, but we had a timeline. We just could not break the... There was just too much of clearance and stuff like that that we had to do with the characters and stuff like that. We couldn't get it, you know, exactly the way we wanted it and get it out there in a bigger way. Oh, man, it's such a... Then I wanted to make it into a television series, and no one would do that. So it'd be a great series.
Yeah, you know? I think it would be.
Pick a new bar.
Right? Yeah. Or have it, you know, like one of those anthologies, like every season he goes to a new bar to clean up or something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't go wrong. I mean, it's an easy equation. I like that.
Well, the film is Day of the Dead Bloodline, and it comes out January 5th. Jonathan Sketch, thanks so much for your time today, man.
You're welcome. And I'm going to find you on Twitter. I think you're on there, Dan.
Yes, I am. At Endeavors Radio is the handle.
Okay, cool, man.
Perfect.
All right, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate Have it. A good day. Ciao.
Bye. Okay, Dan. Bye.
That was Jonathan Sketch. Day of the Dead Bloodline opens today. From an outright slasher film to a much more taut thriller, one could say almost existential. The film is The Strange Ones, and the creators are Lauren Wolkstein and Christopher Radcliffe, who adapted the movie from their 2011 short of the same name. It tells the story of two brothers on a camping trip, but like much of the horror world, not all is what it seems. The film stars Alex Pettifer, Gene Jones, Emily Althaus from Orange is the New Black, and James Friedson Jackson, who earlier this year at South by Southwest won Best Breakthrough Performance for his role in the film. This is my conversation with Lauren Wolkstein and Christopher Radcliffe.
No worries.
Lauren Wolkstein, Chris Radcliffe, hello, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi.
So, the film is The Strange Ones, and it starts off with a bit of a bang, but which is kind of in contrast, I find, to the rest of the movie. What was the discussion you guys had around how to find the correct tone and how to find the correct pacing of the film?
Yeah, interesting question. I think tone and pacing were always on our minds, like, throughout the entire process of making the movie, like, the writing, the being on set directing it, and especially in the edit, we were really trying to find the right sort of ebb and flow of kind of, like, for the movie, you know? And like you said, like, it kind of starts in starts with a bit of a bang, and then you sort of sink into almost this kind of more deliberately paced mystery that kind of unfolds as you go along. And I don't know, I mean, I think when we really discussed the pacing of the movie and the flow of the information, especially, like, we realized that all of our decision making was tied to the subjectivity of the main character, which is Sam, this 14-year-old kid. And so, like, it sort of grew naturally from there, basically kind of like, you know, we wanted to give glimpses into his mindset, and at times it is a very, like, you know, violent and troubled sort of, like, point of view, and at other times it's more mysterious and you're not really sure what to think. And so I think that kind of informed a lot of what the pacing of the movie eventually became.
You know,
and we wanted to present something. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add to that we really wanted to present, like that they were on this sort of, like, innocuous vacation, and that they were traveling to a place that was meant to be kind of idyllic, and so we didn't really want to have Sam go back to the past too much, too often, to, like, we wanted it to be grounded in this this very present moment of him traveling, and not have it constantly flash back to his memories of what happened in the past, and to try to move forward.
Actually, that's a good point, because a lot of the conception of the way the movie works is that we wanted to present like a very simple kind of like relatively mundane scenario, and then gradually peel back the layers of it and kind of reveal information as we go along. And so like that kind of like two brothers on a road trip initial concept that we eventually reveal there's like much more to the story than just that. That was kind of that sort of peeling away of layers was the other sort of major structural kind of like idea that we had for the movie.
You do have a child at the center of the story, and I'm curious, like, what do you think from a storytelling perspective, that what a boy can portray that perhaps an adult can't? Is it a certain sort of innocence?
That's a really good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. I think, yeah. I don't know, I think that for us, like, we were drawn towards, like, this story because it was kind of like maybe a uncommonly dramatic or dark child's story in some ways, you know, like, and I think that's attractive to us because, you know, we're interested in exploring sort of like the idea that, you know, your childhood years or your teen years or the transition from childhood to adulthood is inherently so dramatic, actually, and so much more fraught with tension than pretty much any other time of your life. And the stakes around all the decisions you make feels kind of like life or death, or like you don't necessarily realize what the stakes are, and kind of and like everything sort of just feels so much more heightened and dramatic than it does at other times of your life. And so I think you know, it's a time where also there's like a lot of confusion, where you're trying to figure out who you are and kind of what your place in the world is, and what your ideas of, you know, right and wrong, and desire versus sort of like, you know, kind of like your idea of all these sort of very adult concepts are being formed, and so your decision making is somewhat clouded. And to us, that's like such a human and relatable sort of experience to go through, and like I said, it's inherently dramatic. So I think maybe that's why we were drawn towards it. What do you think, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, everything that Chris said, and this idea that Sam's experiencing a lot of things for the first time, and it's very confusing to understand what those emotions mean to him. And everything does seem like it's life and death when you are that age and just kind of coming into your own, and you haven't really fully formed who you are as a human being, or really what your identity or place in the world is. And that's the kind of perspective that we wanted to ground the story in, and really kind of show this teenager's struggle with his identity and grappling with everything that's happening in his life and kind of coming to terms with all that.
For a teenager, James, who plays Sam, James Freetson Jackson, I find that he's very, very nuanced. It was quite a remarkable performance. How much of that was just him, and how much was your direction?
I think James is naturally, like, super talented. Go ahead, Lauren.
Yeah. No, you go.
I was just going to say, like, he has, like, a natural, like, kind of, like, a very sophisticated and mature kind of like approach to acting and into the material. We were able to direct him with a lot of nuance. You know, we were able to basically treat him like an adult and not really sort of tiptoe around what the movie was really about or what it was saying or what his character was going through. He was very game for like the entire experience, and his parents were very game for it, so that was great. There was like a lot of direction involved in terms of like having him sort of hit the right beats, but he knew on an instinctual level, like kind of the type of performance we were looking for that was quietly nuanced and like not very showy, but clearly had like a lot going on sort of in the silences and in the looks and, you know, just what he would do with his face, kind of like the expressions in his eyes, you know, like he's just got a, you know, a real star quality just in terms of like the sort of the amount of kind of subtext he can bring to silence in that way.
Yeah, and he just kind of, he really, when he came into the audition, he just blew us away with how much was happening underneath the eyes without with doing very little. And he, you know, we saw a lot of kids that indicate a lot of emotion, and with James, it felt like there was so much more going on underneath the surface, and we really liked the idea that we'd cast somebody that would give so much more by doing very little and not having to indicate.
I know, speaking of direction, you guys worked as a team, both as writers and directors. How does that play itself out on set?
Well, we both love to do all different aspects of directing. Chris and I both went to film school together, so we kind of share that same language of film, and we both have directed our own stuff, and so when we came together as a team, we knew that we wanted to work efficiently because we didn't have much time on set. So the way we do it is just pre-plan everything, like, way too much. we really plan and pre-visualize everything before we even get on set so that we know exactly what we're going to do, what every scene's going to look like, what every shot's going to be. So then once we have that plan in action, then we cannot, on set, we can just really work with our actors and give adjustments when they're needed. And since we had that common language, it was really easy for us to direct as a team because of the work that we did before we got on set.
Getting somebody like Alex Pettifer, who plays Nick, what's the feeling like for you as filmmakers when you get a name actor, quote unquote, to do your movie?
I don't know. I think it's, we didn't really sort of go into making the movie with any expectations about like, oh, we want to get like a name actor or somebody really famous. I think like when we started to really think about what actors we knew of that really fit the part and could embody like this role in a way that had to kind of be, it was actually like a much narrower group of actors than we ever thought, like kind of, because they have to be able to seem very charming and handsome and kind of like, you know, attractive in one sense, but then also like be capable of being like very menacing, kind of dark at the same time. And Alex came to us like we didn't necessarily think of him right away, just because his body of work is so different from what we were conceiving of the movie being. And one of our producers suggested him, and when we met with him, like, it was kind of like an instantaneous sort of like realization that he's kind of perfect for it. Like, he really loved the script and understood the material and understood what we were going for, and we realized that like you know, he is like the kind of actor that could do everything we needed the character to do. Like, he's very like handsome, very like seductive in a way, but then also like there's kind of like the capability of playing something very, very sort of menacing and dark at the same time. So for us, it was just sort of all about kind of like the perfect, him having the perfect balance that we needed for the role, and especially like the chemistry that he had with James, like and how they looked together, like, you know, because the movie is so based on sort of not knowing what their relationship is, or sort of believing one thing at the beginning and then later discovering these other secrets that they hold, like, you know, they had, you know, you really had to be able to sort of check all those boxes, and for us, like, Alex kind of like, you know, had that perfect balance of all those things. So as opposed to like just kind of like him being like a name actor or you know, having done like bigger stuff, like that kind of was like less of our focus. I don't know, what would you say, Warren?
Yeah. I mean, like, when Alex came in, the fact that he was just so game to work with us and really dig into the material and do something that he hadn't done before and really kind of change direction with the rest of the stuff that he's done in his career was really exciting for us. And I think that, like, talking to him one-on-one and really getting to know that he was invested in this film and bringing his A-game and really, like, digging into the character in ways that we weren't expecting, I think that really turned us on to working with Alex more than any other actor.
One thing I really enjoyed about the film is that I was never entirely sure what was true. And I'm curious is if there was something you were trying to say about the nature of reality.
Yeah. Cool, thanks. I mean, I think I love when people approach the movie with that kind of open-mindedness, because I think, like, there is, like, a tendency for moviegoers to sort of want a story to be told in a certain way and to be given a certain amount of clarity and answers. And, you know, I think, like, for us, like, we were never really that concerned with, like, or interested in just telling the truth or just, giving answers, or, you know what I mean, like, setting up questions and then answering them. Like, for us, like, you know, in terms of, like, the nature of reality and how we were dealing with that, we wanted, you know, one of our sort of ideas was that, like, perception and reality are oftentimes interchangeable and sometimes mixed and confused. And, like, for us, like, seeing everything through the eyes of Sam, like, his perception becomes our reality through, like, the cinematic language that we're telling the story with. And so, like, we want to, like, see and feel, when you watch a movie, everything that you see and feel is, like, meant to evoke reality. And for us, like, we're seeing and feeling through his eyes, and so we want the audience to kind of sort of feel everything as if it's reality, even if it's questionable whether or not it's true. And so it's kind of like, I don't know, like, in some ways, like, reality and fiction are given equal weight in the movie. Is that, or fantasy and reality are given equal weight in the film. Yeah.
There's a one of my favorite scenes actually takes place early on, and it's very brief, but it's when they're at the hotel room and we see Sam swimming underwater. And it strikes me that out of all the shots in the film, he seemed most at peace there. That is the most peaceful shot of the movie. Is there a specific place for you that puts you at ease or makes you happy, or perhaps is a good place for you to write in and get in the creative zone?
Oh, I like you mean as we write, as we
Yeah. What, you know, whether it's creatively or whether there's just, like, a place that gets you into a certain peace of mind or a certain contentment.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I'm trying to find it right now. It's hard to write and to be alone with your story and to really dig into the story and not have any distractions. So I think the best place to be is really kind of in the woods, in a cabin in the woods where Sam and Nick end up, or a place that's very quiet, without any computers, without any internet, because I think that's the biggest, at least for me, that's the biggest distraction right now.
Yeah.
Is constantly having things that I can do other than what I should be doing.
Yeah.
What about you, Chris?
I think, I don't know. I think for me, like, it's, I think we're always, like, when you're writing scripts, certainly writing this script, like, I was always trying to find, like, a situation or, like, a place that was conducive to, like, the creative process or to really sinking in, because, like, you know, you do realize, like, to write a feature script, you really do have to, like, travel somewhere in your mind and just be engaged there and kind of like shut out other distractions and stuff. And I don't know, I think like, you know, I've tried writing in the library, I've tried writing like in coffee shops or like whatever. Like, I actually think like for me, like I naturally end up writing like at home in bed in the middle of the night, like when most people are asleep. And it's just like the world is relatively quiet, you know, like you're not getting a bunch of emails or phone calls. I think in a way, like maybe that's why I end up writing sort of at night or also like very, very early in the morning before everything kind of gets started. And like, you can kind of like ignore your email and like not, and ignore your phone calls for a little while and like, just kind of like, be alone with your thoughts and the world of the movie, you know? If it's possible to like write down those times for you, like, I think like, I think it helps, you know.
And this film obviously deals a lot with identities. As artists, how do you go about finding your identity? Do you think it's something that's ongoing? Does it last a lifetime, or is there a point where you go, no, this is who I am as a person, this is who I am as an artist?
I think for me it's constantly changing. It's always changing. And I don't know if I fully know who that is yet.
Yeah. I think it is like an ongoing process for sure. Like, you know, I think everything you do is in some ways a reflection of who you are as an artist, and you know, I think like Lauren and I both try to follow the truest sense of our artistic sort of inspiration as we can. And so, you know, for instance, like The Strange Ones felt like, you know, a very vital project for us and one that we think like does speak to who we are as artists, you know. And I think like finishing this film and like having it be out in the world, like, you know, we have certain, I find myself having thoughts about like, oh, well, what do I want to do next? Do I want to do something that's similar to this or something that's like super different? And like, there's like an urge to do something super different just because we've been doing this for so long. And it's like, you know, you have ideas that seem different, but actually it's interesting. Like, I'm like writing a new script now and I'm like, I originally thought it was going to be really different from The Strange Ones. And the more I work on the script, I'm like, oh, there's actually all these like common elements to it, even though certain sort of surface level ideas about it are very different. Like, core principles about it are, I'm finding, are like kind of the same. And so I feel like the more work you do, the more of a common thread you find with yourself, as well as the more sort of capabilities you find in terms of like branching out and like experimenting with like new things. But I feel like, you know, it's inevitably all connected because it all comes from you. You know what I'm saying? So like, yeah, it's like, it is like an ongoing process, I think, but you know, you find yourself through the work, you know?
Well, the film is The Strange Ones and it opens this Friday, January 5th. Lauren Wolkstein, Chris Radcliffe, thanks so much for jumping on the phone today.
Thank you for having
us.
Thanks
for talking to us.
Appreciate it.
Alrighty, have a good one. Cheers. That was Lauren Wolkstein and Christopher Radcliffe. Their film, The Strange Ones, opens today. My final guest is another up-and-comer in the entertainment world, but this time, it's the land of hip-hop. At only 17, Cyrus is already starting to turn heads in Atlanta, and recently played a show in which he opened for 2017's biggest star, Cardi B. Here is Cyrus Sci-Fi Smith talking about that journey. Cyrus, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today, man. Happy holidays.
Happy holiday. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, you said that for a while music was just a hobby for you, and here you are going on tour with Cardi B and Migos. When did the hobby become the career?
You know, I was just in the studio messing around, and
I just thought I was pretty good at it, enough to start a career and to keep it going, and people were giving me good feedback, so I was thinking, you know, why not? You know, like I said, it was never really a planned thing to become a career, but, you know, I live in the moment. Just whatever happens is happening.
And how are you enjoying being on tour so far?
It's pretty good. You know, going to different cities, seeing different things. There are some shows in my hometown that I went to that were pretty cool, so it's all just fun.
Yeah, you know, as we mentioned, you've been on tour with Cardi B and Migos, and she's probably been the biggest name in hip-hop this year. What's that like for you? Because you're on tour with her, and you're sort of getting to go on with this journey with her as she becomes this star. What has that been like for you to witness and be a part of?
Well, I'm not really on tour with her. It's more of one show, but seeing her on that note, seeing her become what she is becoming from what she was, is pretty cool. And I think that it makes a lot of people think it's easier to become what you want to do or what you want to become in life. So I think she's a good role model, and she pushes other people to hustle hard.
So you have a new song being released called Bags. Where did this track start for you?
I just have a lot of bags. Like, I was like, all right, what can I make a song about in bags? I just started buying like Dolce & Gabbana bags and Louis Vuitton bags, and you know, I was like, hey, yo, let me make a song about bags. That's basically it. There's no really huge story behind it. It's whatever's happening.
It seems to me that more so than other types of music, hip-hop always litters itself with a lot of pop culture references. I know in your song I heard references to Ferris Bueller and to Gucci. How do you go about constructing a song? Do you always have a beat first, or do you tend to write lyrics and then fight a beat over that?
I get a beat. I just go in and freestyle. It's not like a writing thing. I write it out and plan everything out. I used to write though, but it's just like I go in, whatever comes up, and then I write the words down once I've made it up already. So it's not. And the references are just like, I would make references to my, you know, past and what I've watched or what I like. Like, I watch a lot of anime. I'll probably make a lot of references to anime, that type of deal.
What was it about Ferris Bueller? Because we hear that a few times. Was that just a part of your childhood growing up?
Yeah. I watched it as a kid, and I was like, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I mean, like, let me just make a reference of it. I wasn't really, like I said, I don't really think too into it. Usually Ferrari, I automatically think Ferris Bueller, since that's, you know, what I grew up around. I grew up around a lot of old shows like Back to the Future.
You're from Atlanta. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I was just saying, you're from Atlanta, which seems to me doesn't get enough credit for how musically rich and diverse it is. Growing up for you there, how easy was it to sort of access the different music and the different types of culture that you were interested in?
Well, I grew up in Cali, so I mean, I didn't always have things I have right now, but I moved to Atlanta a couple years ago, and it was like, me, if you want to do something, do it, because, you know, you can always be in the worst situation, and then that's how I pursue what I want to do. And that's how I think it's just easy.
Have you noticed the difference in maybe the music culture between California and Atlanta?
There's not really a big difference. There's hip hop in both. I think there will be more pop in Atlanta than Cali because a lot of people come to Atlanta to pursue their dreams. So that's like
you mentioned that you're a big fan of anime, and I know one of my favorite it's not an anime show, but it's an animated show shoots it in Atlanta, and that is Archer. What are some of your favorite anime shows or animated shows?
I don't have one specific favorite, but you know, just a couple would be like Sword Art Online, Tokyo Ghoul, Guilty Crown. I like stuff like Naruto, which is more, you know, known than other shows. And Dragon Ball Z, I just grew up on them, so grew up playing games like that, watching the shows, watched like every Naruto episode there is. But I grew up watching One Piece. Just a lot of anime that came on a Toonami.
What's this been like for you? You know, we talked about how, you know, your song being released tomorrow. What's it been like for you having the world starting to hear your music and your passion? Have you adjusted to that yet?
Probably not. I mean, like, I haven't been out long, so probably it's going to take a little bit more getting used to, you know. I got to still get used to I haven't had a lot of hate, but a lot of hate that is coming. I have to just get used to it, pass on, whatever. A lot of love's been coming, and I really appreciate that, and I'm just fortunate like that.
You know, I think it's unfortunate because hip-hop can get a lot of hate and can get a bad rap, often unfairly. What do you want people to know about that genre and what it can do to be a voice for good?
My opinion on that, you know, music makes people feel good, so it's not so much of what I mean, to me, it's just how music makes people feel. If you want to get hyped, make a hype song. That's what people like. And, you know, just the direction on haters, like, as long as they listen to the music, it's not really much they can do. They listen to it, so it's too late by then. I mean,
you know, I think one aspect of being in the public eye is sort of social media and what you say on there. Has that been something that you're becoming more conscious of?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. I just gotta, you know, watch my mouth. Not a lot of it. Like, I would wanna put music on there, but you know, the music's just not for my targeted audience, so I just got to be more conscious of what I say and what I do.
It strikes me that more so than a lot of other genres, hip hop is a very, very collaborative art form. What are you learning most and what are you enjoying most about the art of collaboration?
I think it's fun. But what I would suggest is not stay in one genre, just try around other ones, see how they work out. It's always cool you want to be consistent in what you do, but you also want to try new things.
Any so you've got your single coming out. Is there an album in your future?
Yeah, there's an album coming pretty soon. It's coming real soon. I don't have all the details, but I can tell you it's coming soon.
Well, we look forward to hearing it. The song Bags drops tomorrow, I believe, on December the 28th. Cyrus, thanks so much for jumping on the phone today, man.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
All right, have a good day. Cheers.
All right, you too.
That was my conversation with hip-hop star Cyrus. That's it for the show today. You can follow me on Twitter at Endeavors Radio, and be sure to check out the show's Patreon page at www.patreon.com/endeavors. If you like the show, please consider donating. Taking you out with Bags by Cyrus. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Pull up in a Robbie. Feel like Ferris Bueller. Pull up in a Robbie. Feel like Ferris Bueller. Pull up in a Robbie. Feel like Ferris Bueller. All your diamonds foggy. So come to my jeweler. Say the life or die. That's back to the future. It's too late to stop me. Should've told you sooner. New Gabbana bag. All white fur, so it is polar. That girl all up on me, hold me tighter than my choker. Gucci on my back, I got all my Louis loafers. I don't gotta drive, you know that I got a chauffeur. Back. Hundreds in my Louis. Back. New swag. Back across the stack. Back. Just got a Gucci. Across the rack, wrist, blind, can't see, A.P. frostbite. She don't want me, her friend just might. Louboutins all on my shoes. All these girls, they come in twos. So many, I cannot choose. I am a winner, can't lose. I do the digital dash. I get the throw kinda fast. Get it like a flash. QBC all in the past. Rogers. All these girls don't wanna be cheated on, but they gon' cheat. Can't stand none of these fake people, so I take a seat. I'm from 1600 Inglewood Avenue Street. I came up from the dirt so my homies can eat. Back. Hundreds in my Louis. Back. New swag. Back across the stack. Back. Just got a Gucci. Back. New swag. Back across the rack. Wrist blind, can't see. A.P. frostbite. She don't want me. Her friend just